mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today as we're starting to shift into back-to-school mode, preparing our kids isn't just about getting fresh number two pencils and new clothes, it also means equipping them to deal with the bullies who will also be heading back to class as well. Also this morning in our community and business spotlight, the United Way of Hancock County is gearing up for their annual fundraising campaign, but that's not the only way that you can give. And is your summer reading list starting to look a little thin? We have some great new titles to check out from the Findlay Hancock County Public Library. Sarah Clevidence will be here to tell us what's happening. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Wednesday, July 24th, 2024. So the Summer Olympic Games begin on Friday, opening ceremonies here in just a couple of days, and all eyes will be on Paris. You know, the games are coming to Los Angeles next, right? The next games are in Los Angeles, and today, later on today, from my understanding, the International Olympic Committee will make it official and award the Winter Olympic Games in 2034. I believe it is, to Salt Lake City. They wanted to get the 2030 games, but the Olympic Committee said, well, it's too close to Los Angeles to go back to the United States for the winter games, so they pushed that back to 2034, I think is the game. But that announcement and the official vote will take place, I believe, later on today. And so we'll be getting the winter games. And I thought it was interesting in the story that I saw, Salt Lake City, basically the only city that put in a bid for the 2034 Winter Olympic Games, is getting harder and harder to find host cities for the Olympics because it is such a huge undertaking. But the payoff is also big. Salt Lake City says they're going to see a $5.5 billion economic impact from hosting the Winter Games. And so it got me to thinking, if there aren't enough cities that want to host the games, we should put in a bid. We should. I mean, why not? If nobody else wants to, we'll host them. We'll take the $5.5 billion economic impact. Sure, we could use that, right? Now we can't in Findlay host the winter games. We don't have, you know, a mountain to hold the ski runs. I mean, probably the biggest hill that we have is like the site of the Findlay Reservoir. And I don't think that's really big enough to do the Olympic ski events. So I think, I mean, we could build a mountain, I guess. But but that would be rather complicated and would cost a lot of money. So, you know, I think you need to think about this, how to do it on a budget, you know, to cut down on the cost. I think we could pull off the summer games, though. I really do. I mean, for example, I was thinking about this. We could do the swimming and diving events at the Riverside Park pool, right? They host swimming events there, so we could do that. And if the weather is bad, we can move it indoors to the YMCA. Right? They go to pool inside. So we can make that decision, you know, if the weather is iffy on the day of. I'm sure that would be fine. We do track and field events. They've got a very nice track there at Findlay High School. So we can do the track and field events there. Speaking of the high school, Elmer Graham Stadium can host the soccer events. So a great field that they have there. I'm sure the country club would host golf. So no problem there. We could do the basketball tournament, Croy Gymnasium. So they, you know, have the infrastructure there. I'm sure they, tennis at the YMCA, right? So we got the tennis courts over on the east side. We do the opening and closing ceremonies at Donnell Stadium. And then the Olympic Village, kind of the place where people mill about. They have all of the vendors and, you know, all of that. They do that at Emory Adams. And speaking of Emory Adams, every Olympics they have like demonstration sports that aren't medal sports, but that they, you know, kind of try out at the Olympics. We could do hot air balloon races there at Emory Adams. So we know we can pull that off. And, of course, we can do the rowing events right here at Lake Cascades. See, we've got it. We could do this. And smaller cities have hosted the Olympics in the past. You think Lake Placid, you think Lillehammer in Norway hosted the Winter Olympics a few years ago. I mean, I think we could pull this off. You can't think small. I mean, go big or go home. $5.5 billion economic impact on this. Now, I haven't run this plan by the mayor yet, but I can't imagine that she would be opposed. I can't imagine that they would nix that idea. I think it's brilliant. I think we need to put in a bid. We can do this, people! Let's see. Among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, this is a story that I saw on the State Newswire out of Columbus, and I thought, wow, why hasn't anyone thought of this before? This is one of those head slappers. What I call a head slapper, when you hear it, you think, I should have thought of that. You know, whack. I should have thought of that. Four Columbus fire stations are being outfitted with a new call alert system that will allow first responders to get more rest during their shifts. Because firefighters, of course, work 24-hour shifts. And so they have to sleep at the fire station. But the problem is, when an alarm goes off, it wakes up everyone each time there is a call that comes into the station. But oftentimes, the calls are just for paramedics. They don't need the entire fire station. So with this new system, they will be building separate sleeping rooms for each vehicle. And they'll be soundproof so that the alarm will only wake up the crew for the vehicle that needs to respond to the call. And everybody else can just continue to sleep. The Columbus City Council has approved $600,000 in funding to install the new alert system. The Columbus Fire Battalion Chief Jeff Geiter says new stations that are built from here on out will have these new fire alarm systems installed as well. I think that's brilliant. Why did it take this long to figure that out? I think it's a great idea. Let's see here. Speaking of Ohio news, I thought this was kind of interesting. Ohio-related news. And this is another one of those, what took so long? A bill created by Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio is headed to President Biden's desk for his signature. Finally, it is the All-American Flag Act will require that the federal government buy only flags, American flags that have been completely produced and manufactured in the United States. Up to now, under current law, the government is only required to purchase flags that contain 50% American-made materials. But now, henceforth, once the president signs this bill, the flags that are purchased by the United States government, and they buy a lot of flags, will have to be 100% manufactured and sourced from the United States. And believe it or not, this took like 4 years to get done. It took, but this seems like this should be a no-brainer, right? This should be a no-brainer. And yet it took like 4 years to get done. The legislation finally passed the Senate last year, passed the House earlier this week. But it's been working its way through the process for like 4 years. This should have been done immediately. I don't understand why that took so long. What is the controversy here? What exactly is the controversy? I don't understand. So this is kind of interesting. If you are thinking about laying off employees, if you're a business owner or a manager, and you're thinking about trimming the fat, downsizing your company, laying off employees, you better be ready to deal with a data breach if you do. Researchers from Binghamton University have found a link between layoffs and data breaches. In the first quarter of last year, over 136,000 American employees were laid off. But this downsizing, they say, could make a company more prone to phishing attacks. The first issue is brain drain. the employees who are left at the company might not be as sophisticated in spotting scams. And the most experienced security experts could be gone. The second issue is revenge. Previous employees may be looking to exploit weaknesses that they know about because they worked at the company. Last year, data breaches cost companies $4.5 million, and those costs $4.5 million, or should that say billion? $4.5 million seems very low. Those costs could wipe out any money businesses. The long and short of it is that the cost of dealing with a data breach could wipe out any perceived benefits from downsizing, letting employees go. So, just something to think about if you are considering downsizing your company. Better be prepared to deal with a data breach if you do. That's what they say. Okay. And lastly, among the first things you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, get up, get out of bed right now, and start doing your morning exercises, because apparently we need to do this. We're not doing this enough. The fittest cities in the United States, according to a new ranking by the American College of Sports Medicine and the Anthem Foundation, the fittest cities, Arlington, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. Interesting. Seattle, San Francisco, and Madison, Wisconsin, round out the top five. They ranked the 100 largest cities in the country using multiple indicators, like more than two dozen indicators of exercise, and that kind of thing, how fit these people are. Memphis, Port St. Lucie, Florida, and Oklahoma City are at the bottom of the list. Arlington, Virginia, Washington, D.C., and Seattle, the top three. Cleveland is the top-ranked Ohio city on the list at 48th overall. 48th. That was the top Ohio city. And Toledo, so by extension, Northwest Ohio, 87th out of 100. 87th, people! We need to get up and get moving. So start getting your morning exercises, because apparently we are lacking in this area, according to the latest rankings. There you go. That doesn't motivate you. I don't know what will. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Wednesday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Showers and storms possible today. High in the mid-80s. Chance of storms tonight. Low in the upper 60s. A man is heading to prison after being sentenced on some very disturbing charges in Hancock County Common Pleas Court. Raymond Floyd Carter previously pleaded guilty to two counts of rape of a child under 10 years old and four counts of child pornography. At his sentencing hearing on Tuesday in Hancock County, prosecutor Phil Regal stated that this is one of the most heinous crimes he has ever prosecuted and argued that Judge Starnes sentenced the 35-year-old Carter to life without parole, and that is the sentence that the judge handed down. Get more on this case and this story on our website. A federal judge has ruled on Ohio's new election laws.
A federal judge ruled that Ohio's strict new election laws violate the rights of people with disabilities who rely on caregivers or family members to return their absentee ballots. The state law violates the Federal Voting Rights Act and can no longer be enforced. The League of Women Voters of Ohio brought the suit. The Columbus Dispatch reports that 35 states now allow someone else to return a voter's absentee ballot.
ONN's Tracy Townsend reporting. The Buckeye State will be front and center when the Olympic Games kick off in France later this week.
Ohio native LeBron James will be leading Team USA at the Paris 2024 Olympics opening ceremonies. Basketball star was chosen as the male flag bearer. James says he's proud to be part of this important moment that can bring the whole world together. This is James's fourth Olympics. The men's basketball team start competition against Serbia on Sunday.
ONN's Amy Steigerwald reporting. Blanchard Valley Health System will host a Live and Learn educational presentation on Thursday, focusing on its new acute rehabilitation unit at the hospital. presentation will provide information on the new ARU at Blanchard Valley Hospital, which provides rehabilitation care for patients recovering from stroke, trauma, and other injuries and illnesses. Remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
Well, now that we are starting to get back into back-to-school mode, a reminder that preparing our kids for another academic year isn't just about getting the school supplies and the new clothes. It also means equipping them to deal with the most unseemly side of school, because the bullies are going to be headed back to class as well. Kirk Smalley is co-founder of Stand for the Silent. It is a nonprofit group which offers education and tools in the hope of preventing a tragedy like the one his family experienced. Kirk, your son became one of the saddest of all statistics among kids today when the bullying becomes overwhelming and ultimately just too much to bear.
Yes, sir. Ty took his own life in 2010 at the age of 11 years old from being bullied.
11 years old. It's just hard to imagine. And yet that is kind of where we are. And I want to ask, what are the risk factors that makes a kid susceptible to bullying? Who are the kids most likely to be victims? But the fact of the matter is, when you look at the generally accepted list of risk factors that experts have come up with, it really could include any kid.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, bullies don't seem to have a specific reason to do what they do. Anybody can be a target. Ty was bullied because he was the smallest kid in his class. He was in sixth grade, and he was the smallest in his whole class, and they called him names like Tiny Tam and Shrimp and stuff like that. But, you know, anybody can be affected by it.
So we talk about preparing our kids for dealing with bullies. What are some of the strategies for doing that?
Well, first of all, you know, before we go back to school, we need to go ahead and have that discussion with our kids about bullying, you know. Talk about what bullying is and what to do about it if it happens to them, or if they see it happen to another, you know. Talk about the different types of bullying, how to address it, and, you know, who to go to. We've got to prepare our kids and have those meaningful conversations. You know, that's one of the things that I'm a real stickler about. We've kind of lost the ability to speak to our children. You know, that's when I do presentations, especially open to the public presentations, and talk to parents, that's one of the questions I ask them. You know, how many of y'all talk to your kids every day and ask them how their day was? Boy, the hands go up by the hundreds. And I say, and what do they say? Well, it was okay. It was fine. It was good.
Yeah.
You know, and then what?
Yeah,
well, then they go to their room.
Yeah, that's not a conversation.
No, you know, we don't sit around the dinner table and talk about our day. We eat dinner in front of a television set. I was at a restaurant the other day. I saw a family of four, a mom, a dad, and two kids sitting at dinner, and every single one of them was on a cell phone, you know, thumbs and fingers just flying. They weren't even having a conversation. And we got to get back to that, to where we can, you know, ask those hard questions, you know, and have those meaningful conversations. You know, another thing that we can do is you can role play with your kids, especially the younger ones.
Yeah.
You know, act out some bullying scenes with the kids so that, you know, they can practice on how to respond to that. And that puts them more at ease if it does occur in real life. You get others involved. Parents can start anti-bullying groups. They can start a chapter, a local chapter of Stand for the Silent. The information on how to do that's on our website. It's really super easy. We've made it easy so that people can do it and you know, raise awareness in their community.
Mm-hmm.
It gets more kids involved. It lets the kids that are being bullied have a place that they feel like they can belong, that they're accepted. You know, we even have chapters that were started by bullies that have seen my presentation and said, hey, you know, I never realized that what I was doing could cause something like this.
Yeah.
And I want to help make it stop.
Yeah. There is strength in numbers with respect to that.
That's very correct.
Yeah. You also talk about engaging with the school, with the teachers, with the administration. This is something that frequently kids and perhaps even families feel like they have to, it's a cross they have to bear on their own.
That's correct. Yeah, you know, far too often everybody says, well, the school won't do nothing about it. And, you know, my answer to that is there's always somebody higher up the ladder that we can go to. You know, you start out with the counselor or the assistant principal or the principal, and you move up to the superintendent. If that doesn't solve the problem and get a good response, then you can go to the school board. And if that doesn't help, you can go to the state board of education. And if that doesn't help, we can even go to the federal board of education or Department of Education.
Yeah.
You know, there's always another move we can make. My main thing is don't stop fighting for your kid.
Yeah.
You know,
the other item on your list of, you know, preparedness, I guess, or preparing the kids for dealing with this is teaching self-defense. And a couple of things, I think, on this are important. Obviously, it's important that kids are able to protect and defend themselves if things get physical, but also just from a confidence standpoint.
Yeah, I highly recommend that. You know, I mean, a lot of people say, well, you know, it's not right to tell him to fight back. And see, Ty got suspended because he fought back for the first time in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but we can't just sit there and let it happen to us. You know, I mean, we can't raise a society of children that are, you know, defenseless and don't know what to do, mm-hmm. or how to protect themselves. And, you know, the right self-defense methods, you know, I mean, again, like you said, I mean, that builds confidence and hopefully they never have to use that.
Absolutely.
But if they do, at least they have that option.
You know? In the digital age, much of the bullying that used to happen in the hallways or on the playground has now moved online. In fact, one expert told us just recently that cyberbullying is now more prevalent than physical confrontations. Short of cutting off any and all ways of interacting with technology, which is certainly not practical and probably not even possible anymore, how do we adapt some of these strategies to address that part of the issue?
Yeah, cyberbullying has increased over 75% since the pandemic. Kids are being atrocious to each other online. I mean, you know, they feel like they're anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to schools where first graders have cell phones, smartphones, and they're good on them, you know.
Yeah.
They can create a fake Facebook account. They can take a photo with their cellular device of a kid walking down the hallway or in the locker room in the gym or whatever, and they can Photoshop that and, you know, make it look like that kid's doing anything they want them to do.
Yeah.
And post that picture online and run somebody's heck with the click of a button. You know, we have our parent website is standforthesilent.org, but we opened up another website that deals strictly with cyberbullying, and it's called socialbullets.org. And it has a downloadable guide that's free that teaches parents, because most parents are, you know, the older generation, we grew up without technology.
Mm-hmm.
We're not
right
aware of what to do if our kid's being cyberbullied.
Exactly.
And this teaches them exactly what steps to take if their kid's being bullied online. And, you know, it's got a really powerful video on that website that we had a marketing company that donated $500,000 worth of work to this project. We created an algorithm that tracked cyberbullying for 24 hours across all the social media platforms. And we took a group of high school kids and their parents, and on a large screen, we started that algorithm, and they would see the posts pop up from Snapchat and Facebook that said, you know, you're stupid, you're dumb, nobody likes you, you should just kill yourself. And we caught their reactions to those posts. We made four posters depicting four different types of cyberbullying: age shaming, race shaming, body shaming, and sexual orientation. And every time we reached the number 238, which is how often a child, every time that a kid was cyberbullied online, for every 238 times that happened, one of them tried to take their own life. Mm. And so when we reached that number, we fired a live bullet at one of those posters, and we caught their reactions to that. Mm. And, you know, it's a really powerful tool.
Yeah, I was going to say that's powerful stuff. And you make such a great point that, you know, for many of us parents, especially when it comes to the cyberbullying thing, this is something that we is totally out of our realm of experience. It's hard to know how to react because it's something that we've not experienced firsthand. So again, as we prepare for back to school, these are some of the conversations that we absolutely must have with our kids. Again, Kirk Smalley is co-founder of Stand for the Silent. Kirk, thanks very much for taking the time this morning. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Now, the Good Mornings Community and Business Spotlight.
Putting the United Way of Hancock County in the spotlight this morning, and new CEO Kelly McClurkin is once again with us this morning. Kelly, thanks very much for dropping by. It's about time to get campaign season underway. I know we're just steamrolling through summer here, but before you know it, we'll be into another fundraising campaign.
That's right. Campaign is right around the corner. Mid-September is when we kick off. Mm-hmm. But today is all about not everyone can donate those dollars to campaign.
Right. Yeah. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about the, you know, getting prepared for the campaign. This is, you know, the preparation's already underway. I mean, it doesn't just happen in September.
No, we are planning our kickoff already. We are putting together organization packets for organizations to drop off.
Yep.
You know, our PR materials, we're ramping up.
Yeah, so that is coming here very soon. As you mentioned, though, it's not necessarily something that everybody can do monetarily. That doesn't mean that you can't help out. Lots of volunteer opportunities within the community. The next big one is coming up with the Fall Days of Caring.
Yes, our Fall Days of Caring happened September 16th through the 18th. However, right now, organizations can sign up teams. Mm-hmm. That is during the week. So that's more of a business or organization-based volunteer opportunity that week. But also, nonprofits and organizations can sign up for projects. Both of those are open right now.
Okay, so how do organizations submit their projects to be a part of the Fall Days of Caring?
Sure. So they can visit our website, and that is uwhancock.org.
Okay.
And you can, there is a Days of Caring tab, and then you can click volunteer under that.
Okay.
So the Days of Caring tab will have all that information.
Okay. So it's the same process for volunteering.
Yes. Yes.
And as you mentioned, this is more geared toward groups, businesses that want to have team building events or ways of giving back within the community through employers. But any groups really can participate in this.
They truly can, yes. It is a great event for team building, or a lot of organizations have give that time to employees, paid time for volunteering,
right.
And that's when they take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm.
But just to give an example of the impact that has made, our Spring Days of Caring is a little larger event than our Fall Days of Caring. But in spring, we had 900 volunteers that completed 93 projects for 45 different agencies. in just 5 days, which all of those, that equates to dollars saved by those organizations.
Right.
They can take that money that they, you know, the, for those projects that they would have paid someone to do and put them back into their programming. That equated to over $120,000 going back into our community.
Yeah, that's just tremendous. And even though the Days of Caring is more an event that is geared toward groups of individuals, maybe from a business or an organization of some type, there are individual opportunities to volunteer through the United Way as well.
Sure. Our volunteer center is called Volunteers United, and we have a brand new volunteer coordinator. Her name is Mindy Airy. And you can get a hold of her through our website. Her email is simple. We try to keep things easy. Volunteer at uwhancock.org.
Okay.
And she, you can reach out to her via her email or the website. She's great at talking to people and figuring out their passion and matching them with opportunities as
well. What types of opportunities? I mean, because there are any number of ways to volunteer within the community directly with an organization. So why would someone go through the United Way?
Well, I think it's easy for us. You know, the benefit of going through United Way is we're kind of that matchmaker.
Okay.
So, you know, whether it's something, if you just want to get your hands, you know, dirty and help landscape something or make meals at City Mission. But we also have skill-based volunteering. If you're great at marketing or if you're great at, you know, making Excel spreadsheets and one of our partner agencies needs help in that category. Mm-hmm. We match like skills from each end of the spectrum. When someone's matched with a passion that they have, they're more likely to stick to that, you know, to want to help out more or want to volunteer more. And it just makes you feel better when you're doing something, not just to help someone, but that you love and you're sharing that passion with someone.
Yeah. So again, let's go through. We've thrown a lot of stuff at people. So again, if folks want to volunteer on that individual level, give us that email again.
Volunteer at uwhancock.org.
Okay.
Or the simplest way might just be to go to our website, which is uwhancock.org.
Very good.
And click on volunteer, or on that other side that we were talking about, Days of Caring, there's a Days of Caring tab as well.
Okay, again, so Days of Caring is also the volunteering on an individual level, you can do that anytime.
Anytime.
I mean, anytime. The Days of Caring itself, you've got this window that you have open for, again, the organizations to submit their projects and for volunteer groups to let you know that they are available.
That's correct. And registration does close August 23rd.
Okay. And then the Days of Caring itself is coming up.
Days of Caring itself is September 16th through the 18th.
All right. So kind of put that in your brain when you're planning it out on your calendar. And of course, as we mentioned, the campaign is right around the corner.
Right around the
corner.
Going
to start in September as well.
Yep,
so be watching for that.
That's right.
Again, Kelly McClurkin from the United Way of Hancock County in the spotlight this morning. Kelly, thanks very much.
Thank you.
The Community and Business Spotlight is a promotional advertisement paid for by the featured sponsor.
So one of the big news stories, really the big news story coming out of the day yesterday, Kimberly Cheadle resigned as head of the Secret Service. She had been under intense pressure to do so following this week's congressional hearing into the security failures that led to the attempted assassination of Donald Trump at a campaign rally earlier in the month. And the calls for Kimberly Cheadle to step down are coming from both sides of the political aisle. Now, the chair of the House Oversight Committee has said that her resignation will not stop the committee's demand for more accountability on the part of the agency. And in case you missed it last week, we spoke with Brian Boyd. He's an intelligence analyst and law enforcement professional, 30-plus year career in law enforcement. His career includes stints working at the Departments of Defense, Justice, and the Treasury. Clearly, this was, at a minimum, a severe miscalculation.
This is a massive security failure. And you're looking around the perimeter, and if you see a building within a couple hundred yards that's outside the perimeter, wouldn't that be a logical thing even for a basic Army trainee that that's a position that needs to be secured? And it was not. So that's a major security failure. They didn't secure the building in any fashion. Think about it. And then if you think about the police officer who was supposedly climbing the roof, there's a communication breakdown because what he observed and saw, and I'm assuming something in this case, his comms don't connect directly to the Secret Service earpieces. So what he's doing is he's relaying, and if he did give a mayday call or a failure of a man on a roof and dispatched it, there's a breakdown between state, local communications to the Secret Service people, and that happens to be in the comm center, and that was not relayed in time to warn the Secret Service detail with their earpieces to get the president off stage. So these are preventable. These are screw-ups. These are security failures.
We always learn things when tragedies happen or near tragedies happen. I mean, fortunately, obviously, the former president was not seriously injured. What will be the lessons out of this? Again, there's a lot that still has yet to come out, but based on just what we know now, what are the lessons to be learned here?
Well, the lessons come from the top down. In recent history, when the Secret Service used to be part of the Treasury, because their job and their legal authority is to arrest counterfeiters. They don't have any arrest procedures or process for assassins. They're detailed to the President of the United States. So historically, they are counterfeit agents. And somewhere down the road, they probably should change it. And then when they put them under the Homeland Security, they create a massive bureaucratic overhead structure, which has not enhanced their communications or their ability to get things done, in my opinion. It might be a good logical step to take the Secret Service as an executive office directed to the president, divest them of the counterfeiting, and make them basically a security detail for the president, and then have direct control over them. I think that would be a nice, massive change.
It has been pointed out that the security measures for former presidents and for presidential candidates, and in this case, Donald Trump is both, that the security measures are not the same as for sitting presidents. Should they be? I mean, is that going to be one of the questions moving forward?
Yeah, that's a normal question to ask, and should all their questions be asked? There's been complacency over the years. And the other side of the coin is there should have been air coverage in some form. And thinking about this thing where Kennedy, who's a presidential nominee, has been denied presidential security. And that bothers me because his brother and his uncle were assassinated.
Yeah.
He's a certain prime target.
Talking about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. One of the other points that has been brought up is the fact that there is this constant back and forth between the Secret Service and campaign officials as to where the line should be drawn. Candidates do certainly need to be seen. They need to be out there and to a certain degree accessible by large crowds of people. And the security detail generally tries to be as inconspicuous as possible. How much of that is likely to change as a result of this incident?
I don't honestly see that as a problem. If you've been to any of these rallies, it doesn't matter who, whether it's Republican or Democratic, and you watch over the years as to how they're handled, the people in the campaign all want to be out to be able to shake hands and touch and feel. And that's always a problem for Secret Service, whether they're working a rope line or they're working something else. But most assassination attempts have been up close, much like the Reagan attempt, or long-range rifles, much like Kennedy. But again, if you look at this particular event, this is a failure of competence. These rallies are relatively short, in short warnings. If you think about the resources of the Secret Service, they're sort of stretched thin. They work long tours. They work long hours. They keep long shifts.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the guys on the roof in 100-degree heat, snipers, how many times you have to rotate those guys because you're on a hot tin roof without a cover. But, you know, think about the problem on that. Those guys are there since, what, 7 a.m. in the morning?
Yeah, yeah.
So these are physical issues that have so much to do with it. But I think that's much of the issue. And I guess if you don't mind me segueing, this has very little to do with the motive of the shooter. It has to do with the fact that anybody could have done that because of that hole
right.
in that security.
Part of our conversation from last week with Brian Boyd, intelligence analyst, 30-plus year career in law enforcement, served in the Departments of Defense, Justice, Treasury. His initial take on some of those security failures that led to the attempted assassination of Donald Trump at a campaign rally earlier this month. And again, as we mentioned, the big story yesterday, Kimberly Cheadle, director of the Secret Service, has now resigned her position. But the inquiry into how what happened will continue in Congress. If you want to hear our complete conversation with Mr. Boyd, you can check out the Good Mornings podcast edition from July 16th. That was, last Tuesday? Yeah, last Tuesday's episode of the podcast. Find out more at our webpage, goodmornings.net.
You're listening to Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
Sharks off the coast of Brazil are testing positive for cocaine. Wow! Now, there's a headline that'll grab your attention. Sharks off the coast of Brazil are testing positive for cocaine. Biologists tested 13 Brazilian sharp-nosed sharks in the waters near Rio de Janeiro and found concentrations 100 times higher than previously found. It is not exactly clear how the sharks are coming into contact with the drug, but theories include that it could be from labs where it is being manufactured, or the excrement of cocaine users in the water. We don't know, but sharks in Brazil testing positive for cocaine, as if sharks weren't scary enough. Sharks that are tripped out on coke. Now, that's enough to keep me out of the water, at least off the coast of Brazil. No question about it. If you've got a trip planned to Brazil, don't go in the water. That is the message there. The findings published this week in the journal Science of the Total Environment. You don't have to tell me twice. We got cocaine-addled sharks in the water. I'm not going anywhere near the ocean. That's... Don't have to tell me twice. Elsewhere in the broken news, speaking of animals and people on vacation, charges have been filed against a New Jersey man after he allegedly decapitated a seagull for taking French fries from his daughter. Now, I am not advocating animal cruelty here, and I don't mean to make fun, but how many of us have had that happen? I've had that happen. On vacation, near the beach, you get a bucket of fries, and here come the birds. Apparently, 29-year-old Franklin Ziegler was not happy when earlier this month at Maury's Pier in North Wildwood, New Jersey, the seagull swooped down and took the fries from his daughter. Hey, I paid for those! He actually decapitated the seagull, probably in full view of all of the other seagulls so that they could spread the word, don't mess with this guy. He's been charged with disorderly conduct, animal cruelty, and resisting arrest. And he was actually taken to jail. He was released, I believe, on his own recognizance until pending a court date in the case. But he was actually taken to jail for this. You can get in big trouble. Decapitating a seagull. But who among us hasn't wanted to do that, you know? I mean, let's be honest. Who among us hasn't? Because those fries ain't cheap, you buy on the beach. All right. Let's see here. A Rhode Island man is recovering after shooting himself in the leg during a bar fight. In addition to his injury, the man has been charged with carrying a gun without a license. So, we probably know why he wasn't able to obtain a license. It's probably with good reason that he doesn't have a license to carry a gun. Let's see here. He's also been charged with disorderly conduct and resisting arrest. He was also charged with discharging a weapon in an enclosed area. The incident started late Saturday night when an argument turned into a scuffle and the man allegedly pulled the gun and fired, but struck himself. Cops say the shooter violently resisted arrest and officers had to take him to the ground in order to wrestle the gun away. Not like he was going to hit anybody anyway. let's see here. Man, it's a good collection of broken news today, isn't it? The iconic Wienermobile took a tumble earlier this week on a highway in Illinois. Fortunately, no one was injured during the incident on Monday when the 23-foot-long vehicle, shaped like a hot dog, rolled over on the Tri-State Tollway. The highway had to be shut down for an hour while police investigated. A representative for Oscar Mayer, owners of the Wienermobile, said, quote, "We are grateful that everyone involved is safe and that there were no injuries. Safety on the road is a top priority for us." You don't often hear hot dog companies make a statement like that. Safety on the road is our top priority. There are, in fact, don't worry that this Wienermobile was in the accident. There are actually 6 Wienermobiles currently traveling through the country and spreading the word about the Oscar Mayer delicacy. Well, now 5 of them. But if only there was something that we could maybe wrap around the hot dog to soften it and protect it from. If only there was something like a bun or something, a giant bun. And finally, in the broken news this morning, they say what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Not in this case. A tourist's date with a $1,000 hooker got even more expensive when she made off with $120,000 worth of jewelry that he had with him. The unidentified man hooked up with the pricey lady of the evening after a night of gambling in Vegas back in 2022. He woke up the next morning to find his $85,000 Rolex and $30,000 gold necklace missing, along with $3,000 in cash. Surprise, surprise. The female suspect, identified as Maya Meleski, had a warrant out for her arrest and was finally caught just recently. She was charged with grand larceny, burglary, and possession of stolen property. The man's gold necklace was recovered, but the Rolex and the cash are still missing. What do you think the chances are getting those back? Ms. Meleski is due back in court on August 8th. And hopefully this guy has learned his lesson. But I wouldn't count on it. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report. Update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We started with the cocaine-addled sharks, and it just got better from there. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
WFIN needs your help to stuff the bus with school supplies for needy students in our area. Go to WFIN.com for donation information. Bring your donation to the Yellow School Bus at the Tiffin Avenue McDonald's in Findlay Thursday and Friday, July 25th and 26th from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. and Saturday, July 27th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. School supply registration forms are required and can be accessed at cchsupport.org. Stuff the Bus, brought to you by McDonald's and 1330 WFIN.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. Do you realize how close we are to football season getting started, high school, college, NFL football, right around the corner now, just weeks away. And if there is one thing that Americans are known for, we are huge sports fans. Not just football, it's really any and all sports. We are huge sports fans. A new survey of 2,000 Americans, 2,000 American adults, 32% would categorize themselves as moderate sports fans. 48% would call ourselves big fans, big sports fans, and 20% would classify themselves as raging fans. You know, fan is short for fanatic. 20% of us are in that category, we admit it. And in fact, among those most fervent fans, those raging sports fans, we spend, on average, on tickets and merchandise and streaming services to watch our favorite teams, $879.40 a year on our favorite sports teams. Even more moderate sports fans spend about $376.10 on average. So that's no small chunk of change. We're even moderate sports fans are pretty big spenders. 22% of all fans admit that they have a pregame ritual before their favorite team plays. Maybe it includes wearing special team gear or tailgating, a cookout or something like that. Even praying before the game. We do this. Fletcher Jones of SquadLocker.com commissioned the survey, says these traditions grow out of the bonding experience that it brings, you know, people together. And much of it is because we, so many of us, have participated in team sports, youth sports, during our formative years. 71% of sports fans, today's sports fans, say that they played sports as a kid. Time to get an update on what's happening at the Findlay-Hancock County Public Library as we head into the month of August. Sarah Clevedens is here, and August typically is a little bit of a slower time at the library, kind of recovering from summer read and all of that, kind of gearing up for the fall, right?
Absolutely. Yes, summer read wraps up Saturday,
okay.
Actually.
All right.
It's been a very busy summer for us, so our staff are always glad to take a little bit of a quieter spell in August as they wrap up that summer and start planning for fall programming.
Okay, so summer read coming to a close here soon. And I do know there are a few things happening. I see in the calendar you're kind of leaning into the Olympics with a couple of escape room things, and you've got a couple of other things that are on the calendar as we come up on August.
Yes, I'm really excited about the Can Spider-Man Do Everything a Spider Can program on August 1st. That'll be at Oakwoods Nature Preserve. So we're really excited to work with the Park District on that. It's for grades 2 through 6. We do require registration, only room for so many spiders at this event.
Okay, very good.
And then some students from our friendship city, Kawaguchi City, will be doing a program on Japanese calligraphy, crafts, and snacks on August 7th for grades 2 and up. So that should be a lot of fun,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that'll be fun. So now that will be at the library?
That one will be at the library. Okay. Both programs do require registration, so go to our website, findlaylibrary.org.
And you can sign up there. Now, this is the time of the year, as we were talking about in the lead-in, that maybe your summer reading list is starting to look a little thin.
Mm-hmm.
You've got some new titles, though, that you know, folks might want to check out at the library.
Absolutely. Jodi Picoult is a very popular author with our patrons. She's got a new one coming out August 20th called By Any Other Name. This one is told in parallel narratives. So one of those is 1581, Amelia is a struggling playwright. She hides her Jewish identity and secretly sells her writings to William Shakespeare.
Uh-huh.
For decades, he takes credit for her work. And then the other narrative in that story is in the present day, Melina is writing a play inspired by Amelia's life, which is then submitted to a contest under a male pseudonym. And then her male roommate poses as Mel during the production. So there is a hold list available for that one.
Interesting. And that's an interesting premise, the idea that maybe William Shakespeare wasn't all that.
Maybe.
Like that.
There's Library Read's top pick for August. I don't know if we've talked about what it means to be a Library Read book before, but that's where librarians around the country can submit suggestions of books that are forthcoming that they think are amazing.
Okay.
And then get voted on by again, librarians around the country.
That would be quite an honor.
Right. You know, so this next one is a top pick for August, a Library Read's top pick for August. It's called House of Glass. Apologies to the author if I butcher her last name, Sarah Pekkanen.
Okay.
So Stella Hudson works as a best interest attorney in a custody battle for a young girl. This young girl, Rose, has witnessed the death of her nanny and as a result is no longer speaking. So as Stella fulfills her assignment, she finds herself in a strange place surrounded by murder subjects and secrets that could put her life in danger. That one publishes August 6th.
That sounds like that could appeal on a number of different levels.
Absolutely.
Fans of psychological thrillers and murder mysteries and
suspense,
you know, the whole psychological genre, that kind of thing. Yeah,
so then for something a little bit lighter, this one I actually mentioned last month, but just finished reading it myself, and I give it two thumbs up. It's The Spell Shop by Sarah Beth Durst. It just came out July 9th. This one I would call a cozy fantasy. I don't know how much that genre term is used.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm sure you've heard of cozy mystery. You know,
okay.
Same sort of premise, only with magic here.
Okay.
So, Keela is a librarian in the Great Library of Alyssum.
So that's why you picked it.
Maybe.
Lead character is a librarian.
You know,
of course a librarian's going to read it.
She secrets away these books as the library is burning and winds up on a small island and opens a spell shop, which is highly illegal because the spells are reserved just for, you know, kind of the nobility. But she wants to help her new island
they
maids.
Could be, and they could be dangerous in the wrong hands.
They could. They could. Yeah. But that was a lot of fun. There's a sentient spider plant named Cal in that. And I thought, oh, I can't handle talking plants. But it was really
that
great.
Didn't work out well in like Little Shop of Horrors,
right?
As I recall. So
this was really cute. I was so excited when I read it. I had to go tell a colleague who also loves these cozy fantasy books, and another colleague was telling her about the same book at the same time. So, you know, we're very excited about this one at the library.
Okay, so definitely one to check out. And all of those titles are available at the library. Anything else to highlight as we start to? I mean, we're starting to think about back to school and, you know, the kids heading back to class and all of that. Obviously, lots of resources for, you know, schoolwork and everything.
Oh, my gosh, yes. You know, taking your first foreign language class, Mango can help you. And, you know, as you're learning your foreign language, you need the books that you're going to read for your silent reading time in elementary. We've got stuff for that. You know, A Quiet Place to work on your homework. We've got that.
And for those who are in need of maybe some technology that they don't have available at home.
Absolutely. Public computer is available with internet, Wi-Fi available at the library.
Sarah Klevenant is with us from the Findlay-Hancock County Public Library. A few things going on in the month of August, but most of all, just kind of gearing up for the fall. And a lot of great titles there to pick up if you need something to finish off your summer reading list. We've got a link up for more information at our webpage, goodmornings.net. Sarah, thanks very much for dropping by.
Thank you.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program, of course. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the program by checking us out online. Our little corner of the World Wide Web can be found at goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow on the program, no matter where you stand on the politically divisive issue of student loan forgiveness, one thing is indisputable. The cost of earning a degree is crippling many students and families. Is there a solution that doesn't involve shifting the burden to taxpayers? So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.